You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2023, January 2024 combined issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Outfoxed. Rupert Murdoch dumping Tucker Carlson wasn't about one thing. It was everything. By Brian Stelter. Opening illustration of Tucker Carlson by Brian Stauffer. And it shows him looking perplexed with a cord running out of him, which is unplugged. When Fox News Media CEO Suzanne Scott called Tucker Carlson around 11:15 a.m. on Monday, April 24th, and said, "We're taking you off the air," she didn't give him a reason. To Carlson, cancellation was unthinkable. He was the highest-rated host across all of cable news, and he was suddenly sentenced to execution. It was like somebody canceling Taylor Swift mid-tour or removing Stranger Things from Netflix before anyone could stream the ending. It made no sense. Carlson wasn't given a path to sign off and pretend that it was on his terms, but Scott did offer him one thing, the chance to include his own comment in the press release. For a moment, he thought about saying yes. Maybe he did want the breakup to sound mutually beneficial, but he quickly snapped out of that. He was being dumped, and he wanted everyone else to know it, too. He tapped out a farewell email to his staff, known as the Tucker Troop, before his Fox email account was disabled. "I've never worked with better people in my life, and I don't expect I ever will," he wrote, adding, "I'm a little unclear on what's going on right now, but at this point, it looks unexpectedly bad." Then the news erupted in public. Fox News Media and Tucker Carlson have agreed to part ways, the announcement said, abusing the word agreed and glaringly lacking any quote from the host. His production team was not given a heads up, so they found out that Carlson was gone the same way as everyone else through smartphone news alerts or text from friends. The show's senior executive producer, Justin Wells, was also sacked, but the rest of the staff was still on the clock. They were supposed to stay at their keyboards and whip up a replacement show that very night. Instead, they swapped theories about the canceling. One of his producers thought it was tied to Fox's blockbuster $787.5 million settlement of the Dominion voting systems case, which was struck just a few days earlier. Another producer thought it was triggered by ex-producer Abby Grossberg's lawsuits alleging a toxic workplace. A third wondered if it was somehow related to January 6th protester Ray Epps' interview on 60 Minutes the night before, when Epps said, "Carlson was going to any means possible to destroy my life." Epps was believed to be preparing a lawsuit against Fox, which he would file in July. The reason Carlson's team couldn't immediately settle on one simple explanation is because there wasn't one. Though Carlson would later suggest his ouster was a condition of the Dominion suit, there's no evidence to support that theory, and both parties deny it. According to my reporting, many factors contributed to the defenestration of Carlson, which ranks among the biggest bombshells in cable news history, not only because of what his exit meant for Fox, but also what it meant for the Republican Party. Carlson was believed to have Trump-like hypnotic power over the GOP base. He was believed to be irreplaceable, but that impression was, in large part, a creation of Carlson's. In truth, Carlson had alienated so many people, instigated so many internal and external scandals, fanned so many flames of ugliness, that his firing was inevitable. After all, he'd been fired from CNN and MSNBC earlier in his career. That's why, at Fox, he puffed out his chest and pretended to be immune to attack. His long relationship with career vulnerability caused him to foster an image of untouchability, and it worked so well that even now, more than 6 months after his exit, people are wondering why it happened. The fact that Fox had no firm plan for its marquee 8 p.m. time slot, no splashy outside hire, no new graphics, no innovative new format, speaks to how suddenly and sloppily Carlson had been terminated. But some of Carlson's staffers were not entirely shocked. They knew they pushed the envelope far past the point of a paper cut. It was always going to end badly. One Carlson producer said, "We knew we were burning too bright." The royal "we" was something Carlson always used. He portrayed his production team, and only his team, as a force for good in the battle against the evils he presumed nightly. His entire show was about us versus them, and this approach extended to the rest of Fox, where Tucker Carlson Tonight had the appearance of a rogue unit. According to a Grossberg lawsuit, Carlson's bro-fest environment was antagonistic toward other Fox shows, including Maria Bartiromo's, where she had worked before. Grossberg said she was hauled into Wells' office in her first week on the job and asked, "Is Maria Bartiromo effing Kevin McCarthy?" "No," she said. Through interviews for my book, Network of Lies, I found that Carlson's producers and writers were more loyal to him than to Fox as a network. They were a saboteur squad of true believers, regarding the mothership as almost enemy territory, since as a Fortune 500 company, Fox Corp had policies in place promoting diversity and supporting transgender employees, the very types of things Carlson railed against on air. Of course, Carlson always genuflected to Fox in public, praising the network for letting him say what we think is true. But his expressions of gratitude to Fox didn't fool management, because they knew how he acted in private. 6 years in prime time had reshaped Carlson, darkened his heart, driven him to the edge. He berated Fox News executives in New York. He belittled people like me who scrutinized him. In the view of some of his own colleagues, he became unglued. While at Fox, Carlson always specified that he worked for the Murdochs, which was a way to elevate his standing and diminish what the org chart said. That his opinion show, like all the others, reported through Executive Vice President Mead Cooper to Scott, who was a rare female CEO in the male-dominated TV business. According to sources on the staff, Carlson shit-talked both women as well as his number one enemy within Fox News, the entrenched public relations boss Irina Briganti, whom he called the C-word. Carlson's internal critics, of whom there were many, viewed his treatment of the female executives as part and parcel with the misogyny displayed on his show. More than a dozen current and former Fox staffers brought this problem up to me unprompted. "Tucker is very titillated by misogyny," a host said. Some of the staffers theorized that his mother's mistreatment, she abandoned the family when Carlson was six, engendered a negativity toward women. The counterpoint I heard from a Fox lifer was that Tucker didn't respect anyone of any gender. Carlson hit men with the same C-word, too. So, according to Fox's Boys Will Be Boys etiquette, He was apparently an equal opportunity basher. Remember, this was supposed to be a defense of him. Carlson told a friend that the F word is so overused, it's lost all its power and meaning, so the C word was more effective. It's super naughty, but it's to the point. His brand, weird as it was, revolved around the idea that he could call anyone the C word, or anything else, at any time. He could say anything, do anything, and never be held accountable, so long as he commanded the attention and affection of millions. On the inside, that was partially true. Scott, for example, was personally disgusted by some of Carlson's on-air comments and off-air conduct, but felt hemmed in by Rupert and Lachlan Murdoch. She was in charge, except when she wasn't. Relatively early in his years at Fox, Carlson struck up a personal relationship with Lachlan, who became the CEO of a slimmed-down Fox Corp when Disney acquired most of Fox's entertainment assets in 2019. Most Fox hosts didn't know Lachlan personally, but Carlson did, and he made sure everyone else knew he did. "You couldn't ask for a better relationship," he bragged of the Murdochs in 2019. "They are completely supportive. They are nice. They are fun to eat with. They've never asked me to go easy on this person or tough on that person." Media reports about the stream of controversies Carlson invited on himself and the company often emphasized this family connection, as if to say, "Doesn't matter. He's safe." Internally, too, Carlson and Wells routinely dropped Lachlan's name to get their way. "I'll talk to Lachlan. Lachlan told Tucker he could do this." But this portrayal they encouraged of Carlson and Lachlan as regular dinner mates, just two middle-aged dads working together to right all that was wrong with the world, unraveled when both men were under oath in depositions. When asked about Carlson, Lachlan said they only spoke rarely. When asked the same question about Lachlan, Carlson chose the same word, rarely, volunteering that it's not on a weekly basis or even a monthly basis. A text message from Carlson to Lachlan in September 2020 also suggested some serious distance between them. "Lachlan, it's Tucker. Hope you're great. Thanks for staying strong through all this insanity. We're all grateful for it." With its whiff of obsequiousness, that sounds like the way you address the guy who owns your company, not a close friend. So Carlson was not invincible, but outside Fox, where perception mattered more than reality, he had seeded a compelling story that he controlled one of the most powerful TV brands in America, that he fearlessly defended free speech from the censors and the liars. "Carlson is no ordinary TV host. He is a movement," Wells proclaimed. Like most of Carlson's stories, this was wild hyperbole, but hypnotically powerful to the people primed to believe it. Fans told him all the time that he should run for president in 2024. There was even a draft Tucker pack. So that's why, on that Monday morning in April, Carlson didn't think long about finding contentment from cancellation and retiring from public life. Instead, he defied Fox's lawyers by posting videos on Twitter, now X, and began to raise millions for a new media venture. Carlson's brain immediately ballooned with theories about his dismissal. He suspected it was the father's doing, not the son's. He wondered if it might be related to Rupert's recent romantic entanglement. On April 4th, when Vanity Fair's Gabriel Sherman broke the news that Rupert had broken up with Anne Leslie Smith, his fiancée of only 2 weeks, Sherman wrote that one source close to Murdoch said he had become increasingly uncomfortable with Smith's outspoken evangelical views. 1 week later, Sherman relayed this quote from a Murdoch source. She said Tucker Carlson is a messenger from God, and he said nope. Carlson's friends believed Rupert was freaked out by his fiancée's comments, plus sketchy details about her past, and thus called off the wedding and, perhaps to rub it in, canceled her favorite show. They buzzed about other possibilities, too. One theory held that Lachlan was showing his skeptical siblings, James and Elizabeth, that he was a suitable long-term leader of the firm. Yet another theory focused on the Fox Corp board of directors and its belated awareness of damaging text messages from Carlson, text that Dominion intended to display for the first time at trial. The most incendiary, as yet unpublished message was from the day after January 6th. Carlson reflected on watching a video of three or more Trump guys surrounding an Antifa creep and pounding the living shit out of him. Jumping a guy like that is dishonorable, obviously, Carlson wrote. It's not how white men fight. Yet suddenly, I found myself rooting for the mob against the man, hoping they'd hit him hard or kill him. I really wanted them to hurt the kid. I could taste it. Then somewhere deep in my brain, an alarm went off. This isn't good for me. I'm becoming something I don't want to be. The moral of his story was about the dangers of dehumanizing political opponents. But the words, "it's not how white men fight," are what startled some Fox board members. It similarly disturbed Dominion executives who read it during the discovery process. The text indicated a view of racial superiority that contradicted Carlson's frequent and much doubted claims of colorblindness, and set up an excruciating cross-examination scenario in court. This much is known for sure. The Fox board retained Wachtel, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz, a notoriously powerful white shoe law firm, to investigate Carlson and any other malign messages that might exist. There were major concerns about liability, an executive told me. Within a week, Carlson was out. The legal probe was a conceivable reason why he was ousted, but it was hard to square the purported distress over the text with the disturbing performances that Carlson put on night after night. So what else could it be? Carlson's position on Russia's invasion of Ukraine, for which he was accused of pro-Putin sycophancy, was thought by some of his supporters to be another reason for Lachlan's action. Carlson's allies kept coming up with new theories, new ways he had transgressed, which only reinforced his opponent's view that he was long overdue for a comeuppance. After he was fired, Carlson claimed to know for a fact that he was canceled due to Dominion. They agreed to take me off the air, my show off the air, as a condition of the Dominion settlement, he told Chadwick Moore, a friendly biographer. His camp also leaked this claim to Variety in mid-May, with the added detail that an unnamed Fox board member told Carlson about it on April 26th, 2 days after the cancellation. I felt like I was witnessing the live birth of a conspiracy theory. Dominion refuted it about as strongly as any company has ever denied anything and said Fox should take every effort to stop these lies immediately. Indeed, Fox did, calling the claim categorically false. Of course, a conspiracy-addled brain would think they agreed to deny it. Conspiracy theories are self-sealing in that way. Author Michael Wolff later suggested in his book, The Fall, that Rupert secretly agreed to drop Carlson as a condition of the Dominion settlement, some kind of gentleman's agreement, but for which there's no direct evidence. Nothing about Carlson's condition of the Dominion settlement statement made sense. Dominion harbored no special ill will toward Carlson. Given his aggressive vituperation in the transcripts, he actually helped their case by lambasting former Trump lawyer Sidney Powell. His name did not come up at all during the negotiations, according to my sources who were involved in the talks. Though he was still being paid, and handsomely, in pay-or-play status, he was unable to work for any other network. So Carlson's attorney, Brian Friedman, had ample reason to seek maximum leverage to get the contract dissolved. In a May 9th letter to Viet Dinh, then Fox's chief legal officer, Friedman accused Fox of fraud and breach of contract because, he wrote, the network promised that it would not settle with Dominion in a way which would indicate wrongdoing on the part of Carlson. We just put Dominion back on the table, a Carlson friend bragged to me, asserting that this move would help win Carlson his freedom. Making Dominion a bogeyman also fit neatly into Carlson's us versus them framing of the world. He told his biographer that the lawsuit was silly and that the whole point of the case was to emasculate Fox, take Fox out of the game because Fox was a huge vector for Donald Trump. Dominion got it in front of some sort of partisan low IQ jury, Carlson continued, staying in character and demeaning the majority black jury, and Fox worried they were going to lose, he said, so they settled. That's not justice. That's a scam. Let's step away from the conspiracy cliff. Carlson was not a victim of the settlement, but Dominion did deserve credit for dragging some of Carlson's intolerability out in the open. It's one thing to know about abusive language and angry emails. It's another thing to have it all read back to you during a deposition, a source observed. And to have the Fox board retain lawyers to read through his deepest, darkest text. People were telling Rupert and Lachlan, this guy is not worth it, an insider said. That's why Dominion's wins were a tipping point, even though Carlson's termination was not part of the settlement. So why was he removed? And what does it reveal about the network of lies? Think for just a moment about the worst relationship in your past and why it ended. Odds are there wasn't just one reason. It wasn't one thing. It was everything. A book's worth of fights and slights and resentments and grievances. Maybe there was a final indignity, an affair, a betrayal, the discovery of a derogatory text. But even if one party was blindsided, the other could list a dozen long gestating reasons for the breakup. That's why Fox dropped Carlson. It wasn't one thing. It was everything. Yes, he was in the sights of the Fox board. Yes, he was under scrutiny for his C-word text. Yes, his white men fight message made matters worse. Yes, his show's climate was so hostile that Grossberg had standing to sue. But there was so much more. Carlson repulsed large swaths of the company he worked for. He created internal strife with his conspiratorial commentaries. He exposed Fox to defamation suits from the likes of Ray Epps. He offended key executives and seemed to take delight in doing so, to the point that managers believed he broke rules and norms just to show he could. He strained friendships, as Rupert's and Lachlan's chums repeatedly complained to them about his poisonous rhetoric. He triggered so many ad boycotts and turned off so many advertisers that his time slot was far less profitable for Fox than it should have been. And he committed the cardinal Fox sin of acting like he was bigger than the network he was on. It was a tale as old as TV. Stardom is a potent and often destructive drug. Icarus flew too close to the sun. He got his wings melted. Carlson flapped away higher and higher until one day the Murdochs just couldn't tolerate his flapping anymore. He got too big for his boots, Rupert told at least one confidant. While Rupert was involved in talks about potentially throwing Carlson overboard, my reporting indicated that Lachlan, not Rupert, made the cold-blooded business decision to do it. Lachlan notified Scott on the evening of Friday, April 21st, and waited until Saturday to tell Rupert, according to two C-suite sources. Then, Scott made the "you're fired" call to Carlson on Monday. The executives made a conscious choice not to state a reason for the breakup. Thus, a dozen different possibilities filled the information vacuum. It's Dominion all over again, one lawyer sighed, as conspiracy theories about the firing festered. It all called to mind what one of Rupert's former deputies told me. He is loyal, 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 until the minute you're dead. By pulling Carlson's plug, Lachlan showed the same trait. This article, copyright 2023, by Brian Stelter, adapted from the forthcoming book Network of Lies by Brian Stelter, to be published by One Signal Publishers, an imprint of Simon & Schuster, printed by permission. Now, here's the cover story. The Great. With Barbie, Greta Gerwig injected billions into the box office and joy back into Hollywood. If she has her way, and there's every reason to think she will, she'll be doing the same thing for the next 40 years. By Sloane Crosley. Photographs by Norman Jean Roy. Styled by Natasha Reut. Opening photo, director's cut. Greta Gerwig, photographed in Brooklyn in September. Unless you've been living under a dream house, you know how this works. In Barbie Land, all Barbies are named Barbie, and all Kens are named Ken. But in real life, everyone is Enya. Everybody gets sail away, says Greta Gerwig of her ringtone. Everybody. In addition to a successful acting and screenwriting career, she starred in Greenberg, Frances Ha, and Mistress America. Gerwig was personally nominated for 3 Oscars between Lady Bird and Little Women. Then, this year, her 40th, came Barbie, the highest-grossing film ever helmed by a woman, a commercial anomaly even for its stars. Gerwig also wrote Barbie with her life partner, the writer and director Noah Baumbach. That she maintains a carefully curated existence seems at once a Hollywood rarity and the tentpole of her success. She uses words like rigor and essential a lot, and eschews social media, that terrifying construction of a self through taste. In short, she likes what she likes, be it Truffaut or Titanic, which she saw 8 times as a Sacramento teen, and wept beyond anything I thought I was capable of. Perhaps this explains why this past summer, a certain generation of women watched Margot Robbie zipping along in her pink Corvette, a halo of blonde hair over her shoulder, singing along to the Indigo Girls' Closer to Fine, and thought, am I really watching this? Or rather, am I getting to watch this? The answer is more than $1.4 billion worth of yes. This is not just children of the 90s speaking. Gerwig, along with Taylor Swift, has had the most quantifiably successful year of any artist on the planet, creating a paradigm shift that brought people back to theaters just as Swift brought them back to stadiums. Getting her to acknowledge any of this, however, is like asking Ken to put his shirt on. Gerwig says she has not read a word of the Barbie reviews. I'll probably sit down with a binder sometime in February, she told me, but right now it's too fresh. This is the first extended profile she's agreed to since the Barbie bonanza, so speaking with her really is a little like speaking with someone who's been living under a dream house, except she's the one who built the house. She credits everyone but herself for Barbie, which mostly reads as deference to other people's talent and aesthetics, but can run at odds with the movie's impact, globally as well as personally. She concedes that this year is the most that I've ever been recognized in my neighborhood, but beyond the radius of NYU, I don't know. The money is also hard to wrap my head around. She has an osmotic sense of the genuflection and the backlash. Is Barbie second-wave feminist? Malibu wave feminist? But there was such a cacophony, so it was more like, wow, what a breadth of reactions. Gerwig refers to her leading actors, namely Saoirse Ronan and Margot Robbie, as pathologically unfrilly. Of Ronan, try having a mystical conversation with Saoirse about what happened in a scene, and she'll be like, I just memorized my lines. Of Robbie, Margot comes from Australian soap operas, and she's a deep, true artist. But she also knows what it's like to get 2 takes max and 40 pages of dialogue a day. But this is also a perfect description of Gerwig. Talent out, head down. Everything I know about the movie's success is an anecdote, she insists, shoes off, knees tucked, as we sit on a minimalist sofa in her office wearing black T-shirt dresses from the same brand, which neither of us comment on. Apparently, there was a very high percentage of people who said they couldn't remember the last movie they saw in a movie theater. When I agree, she's had quite the milestone this year, she replies, yeah, turning 40 is a big deal. By which I mean the major motion picture Barbie. Oh, she says, smiling. Surely, there was a fulcrum moment within her circle of friends when the Barbie marketing campaign started to feel like the NSA had a hand in it. Gerwig is close with her sister-in-law, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Annie Baker. Gerwig and Baumbach aren't legally married, but she uses the usual terms. Josh Safdie, college pal Kate McKinnon, also known as Weird Barbie, and Baumbach's friends who have become hers as well, Brian De Palma, Jake Paltrow, Wes Anderson. But she has had the same core group since college, which she calls a genuine treasure. They came as her guest to the 2020 Vanity Fair Oscar party in coordinated chartreuse. I am curious if life ever went from these people texting her photos of the Warner Brothers water tower painted Pepto to thinking, my coffin might be pink. God, when did it sort of kick in? I always had a hope that it would connect. I had a sense that it might. But Barbie doesn't fit neatly into a preordained category. We had these hopeful-looking metrics, but no one knew what they meant. It wasn't until the end of the second weekend that I thought, oh, this is going well, she says. I mean, Wonder Woman was hugely successful, but superheroes exist in a different bubble. It's too early for Gerwig to feel the need to put air between myself and this thing. The details of Barbie still crack her up. The scene when Ryan is throwing all her clothes out and Margot goes, not the palazzos. The way she says it still gets me. But she does feel slightly more self-conscious when I have pink accessories, like this is just my water bottle. Still, she wore the personalized pink purse that Gucci sent her. I'll bring it next time, she says, with playdate-level enthusiasm. To a recent dinner with Little Women, star Laura Dern, Zoe Kravitz, and Swift. Laura was like, hey, we're getting dinner. Want to come? Gerwig assures me this meal was not focused on world domination. Well, with the possible exception of a toast from Dern. Laura is a person who reaches back into film history, but also brings people together, younger and older people. I wonder if it's worth it, trying to graft such praise back onto Gerwig, where it so clearly applies, without her shimmying away from it. Gerwig's gravitation toward joy in tandem with her rigor has created a rare kind of celebrity for a director, not to mention a feeling of kinship. We do simultaneous impressions of Rita Wilson in Sleepless in Seattle, doing an impression of Deborah Kerr in An Affair to Remember. When she agrees with you, she points close to your face. This sounds bad, but it's refreshingly unself-conscious and strangely welcome, perhaps because it feels earned. This is someone who glosses over nothing. In response to a tossed-off analogy regarding the meal options at weddings, I think the fish or chicken or vegetarian question is funny, because it's this concrete instance of having an interaction with your past hopes for your future self, and your future self hopes that you will want salmon, but it's wrong. Such speedy analysis allows her to be both cool and uncool at once, the former being the vital ingredient to surrounding herself with artists, with people who put themselves in the way of art, the latter being the vital ingredient to capturing adolescence. Gerwig's body of work is like a funnel by which the popular is distilled through the particular. She has cited classics like Singin' in the Rain, I Love the Razzle Dazzle, and The Truman Show as touchstones for Barbie. But the movie also shares DNA with The Wizard of Oz down to that heel-centric moment. "Magic through feet," she exclaims. "Did you know they tried to cut Somewhere Over the Rainbow? They thought it slowed everything down and was boring and people wouldn't like it." No one at the studio ever asked if you really needed all those musical numbers. There was some of that. Some, "You need what? Why do we need a dream ballet here?" I was like, "Because it will be a delight." But there's always a moment with every movie where they say, "You could cut this, you could cut that." And I end up saying, "Or we could cut the whole movie. We could just cut the movie. We don't have to do it." She's speaking about integrity, but she's also, purposefully or not, speaking about power. While Gerwig would gladly act again, she always felt acting was training for directing. This is the wedding guest who ordered very wisely for her future self. But I didn't say it out loud for a long time. It's like that part in Just Kids, where Patti Smith is watching Jim Morrison on stage and has that clarity of ambition, knowing she had the thing. But I think, particularly for female artists, there are very few admissions of knowing. I now understand why Gerwig assumes turning 40 is the biggest piece of information in the room, because for her, it is. She parcels her life in movies yet to be directed. It's why she tries to stay active, not just for her sons, Harold, 4, and baby Isidore, but because what she does is extremely physical. I think about it all the time. If she keeps making movies at this clip, she could make 3 or 4 before 50. I want to do this into my 70s. I think it was Truffaut who said, "Sometimes quantity is impressive." "I know what he means," she says. "I just want to be thought of as, like, she's good. She can do it." "It's not a club," says Anderson, for whom Gerwig voice acted in Isle of Dogs. "But when somebody's directed movies, they've been through this slightly crazy experience. It's a slightly surreal thing to do with your life. To me, it means you're good if you can make one good one. And Greta is a veteran now. She's established that she's in command of it all." She is also but human. And while she may have been able to shield herself from the cacophony of takes post-Barbie, she was familiar with the 64 years of them pre-Barbie. Honestly, there was nothing but fear around all of it from the outset. You're dealing with a topic that is already so filled with opinions. But the trick is to say, well, instead of trying to tiptoe around it, what if we just stepped in it? And the whole undertaking was definitely like, drive it like you stole it. Go, go, go. Don't tell them. Don't tell them where we're going. 2 days later, I meet Gerwig for breakfast at Bouvette in the West Village. She arrives a tad late, hair damp, plops down in a booth, and promptly orders the first of 3 Americanos and 2 breakfast. She was hardly closed off before. Her mind is a cabinet of curiosities. An index of our chats would include Beyoncé, Peter Bogdanovich, Joan Didion, the Coen brothers, Sarah Polley, Preston Sturges, Fruits with those little white outfits that you take off, the Master and Margarita, also known as a Wackadoodle Russia, her obsession with Love is Blind, and being chuffed at the Barbenheimer phenomenon. Chris Nolan is one of my heroes, a proper auteur. It was an odd pairing, but it's kind of like a film festival where you watch 3 movies a day. But she seems more personally open today. Something is different. Perhaps that something is her son, Harold, who mere hours ago took a dump in the radiator. "One more time," I ask, pushing my menu aside. "So the radiator is at the foot of his bed, and the cover is like a house with all these slats. We needed to get tools to take it apart. Also, the baby was up at 5 a.m. singing, which is cute, but oh my God. And then we had to get bleach and a bucket of water from the basement because by coincidence, they turned off the water to our line of apartments." "Well, at least the radiator wasn't on." "Was the radiator on? It's that radiant heat you just can't control. Can I ask you a disgusting question, since we've crossed some kind of gross-out Rubicon? Was it? No, not per se. It was formed enough, but it hit every branch on the way down. I read it as an accident. Noah reads it as a slightly more purposeful gesture. What, I wonder, are Harold's gripes? Yesterday, Gerwig asked me if I wanted to see a video of a baby laughing, assuring me it was her baby. I watched footage of Isidore convulsing with infectious giggles at his older brother. Aside from Harold's unrequited love for a manual lawnmower at their friend's home in Montclair, New Jersey, he's so happy. Also, he gets such good construction sites in New York. And he knows when the alternate side parking is, because that's when the street sweeper comes. Gerwig alludes to general maternal guilt, but she also says that she and Baumbach will never direct a movie at the same time. The writer part of me was on strike during the Barbie promotion, Baumbach explains, so I was home a lot with the kids, which is great. It's an enormous amount to take in at once. But Harold was also very young when Little Women and Marriage Story were both released. You just kind of do it. Considering her aura, it's a plot twist that Gerwig is surrounded by boys. My dog is a girl. She is also stepmother to 13-year-old Romer, Baumbach's son, with Jennifer Jason Leigh, whom he divorced in 2013. Gerwig says she has known Romer since he was 2 years old. Just the decibel level is just... How are three boys 100 boys? If I had to pick, I probably imagined myself with girls. But I'm so delighted by these wonderful boys. It's sort of like the questions I get about being a lady director. I can only ever be the director I am, which happens to be a lady director. Before Harold, I read all those books about ambivalent motherhood. I was scared, because I really liked Romer as much as I loved him. But luckily, I've had a very beautiful experience. Hold on. There are entire books on what to do if you don't love your children? You'd be surprised. I find all parenting books extremely stressful as a genre, because the meta message in them is, if you don't do this right, your kids will be messed up forever. Parenting is like directing, she muses. By the time you get to the end of a movie, you know how to direct that movie. You learn how to do it while you're doing it, but then it's over. The moment's gone. And kids are like movies. You've never had this one before. You just don't know what it's got up its sleeve, and is this going in about the shit in the radiator? We decide to change the topic to something people do want to know about, at least in a less niche way, the speech. There is an impassioned monologue embedded in Gerwig films, delivered by a woman who longs to be her most authentic self. Though what Saoirse says in Little Women, that's Louisa May Alcott. In Barbie, America Ferrera delivers it. Though Gerwig and Baumbach co-wrote the screenplay, much of Barbie's dialogue is rich with female experience. She confirms that the play the guitar at you wording is hers, though I don't ask so much as demand a verbal confirmation. This is an organic process. It would be tricky to color code who wrote what, and Gerwig has a horror of outlines. They bring each other scenes, she says, read them out loud and riff. Still, theories abound regarding Ferrera's monologue. I can't remember, honestly, but yes, I wrote it, Gerwig says. There's clearly enough awareness of the speech's importance to inspire theories between Baumbach and Gerwig themselves. Noah has a totally different memory of it. He was like, no, we were walking. And I was like, no, I was sitting outside. Regardless, Gerwig quickly points to a third party. It does not exist as it does without America. It's hers by right, more than anyone else. That scene still really touches me. I see some of my friends' teenage girls who don't think they're good enough, but they're so beautiful and so smart, and you just want them to know. Gerwig was never taking requests, but now feels like a good moment to express my disappointment that another product of the 90s, Teen Talk Barbie, played by Industries' Marissa Abella, didn't deliver her infamously offensive line, "Math class is tough." "Oh, we did it," she emphasizes. "It just never fit because it was such a weird, long list of crap," she says, "like it belonged in a horror movie." Gerwig pulls up the truly outrageous, shout out to Jim, Teen Talk Barbie statements on her phone, beaming as she reads them out loud. It is, in fact, a weird long list of crap. But it would be funny, even if it wasn't all about malls and ponies and beach parties. Even if it were sentences like, say, "I adore Sacramento. Truffaut was bigger for me than Godard. I love show people. I don't like milk made from other things." Even the most extraordinary women will sound silly when filtered through a doll. Gerwig's feat was that she gave Barbie a soul while still having her speak exactly like herself. "She directs as she is," Baumbach says. "It's not a performance. She's utterly herself." Actors feel like here's someone who is also laying themselves bare, and it gives them confidence to let go of habits that they may have formed to be brave. She's just there without any pretense, figuring it out alongside everyone else, and it's inspiring to people. With Barbie, I saw her direct on set more than I have before, and I felt, she's delivering a speech today? I don't know that I've ever delivered a speech. It's intoxicating. I will be a different director having gone through this movie with her. Speaking of paradigm shifts, Hollywood has gone through three distinct ones in recent years. #MeToo, COVID, and the strikes. Gerwig is a three-guild member, writer, actor, director. "It's been a lot of upheaval and reassessment," she says. "But will any lessons last?" I ask her how much of the swirling crap that led to #MeToo ever hit her. Poor phrasing, given the morning's events. Gerwig is relieved to be luckier than a lot of people in terms of not having truly traumatic things happen. Part of this is, indeed, being one step removed from the apparatus because she lives in New York. "I get to use the studio system, but I don't have to live in it. And I'm conscious of not wanting to be too attached to what Hollywood thinks is a good or bad idea, because I don't want to know if my idea is ridiculous. And when you live in L.A., you know everybody. They all know each other's lawyers. I often don't know who the powerful person in the room is. These days, it might be her. That being said, there's plenty of stuff that happened in my life when I look back at it. I'm like, wait a minute. That was not okay. Just a million little things. It almost didn't register. Which might be generational, you know. I think one substantive change is intimacy coordinators. They make perfect sense. It's like a fight choreographer. Nobody would ever say, just take these swords and see what happens. Just duel a little and see where the spirit takes you. That's insane," she says. "Aside from being a woman, the parallel world I see is getting stuck in some whirlpool of development where you never get out. You never get the thing made or find the right champions. I've been extremely lucky that I've managed to be supported by the system and not eroded by the system." She has also been supported from the creative side, becoming someone who has both found the right champions and done some championing. My experience with directors is totally generous. They'll get on the phone and talk to you about how they did it. It's not guarded at all. I mean, everybody has their own ego and their own sense of competition. But if I ask, they would spend all day showing me how they did it. I know, because I asked Steven Spielberg to do it before I shot Little Women. He showed me all his research from Lincoln. He showed me everything. She's a spectacular talent, Anderson says. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.